Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty coming up on this edition. We'll find out why there are protests in Spain over proposed changes to the working week. And we're going to hear about the spat between Elon Musk and the UK after he was snubbed from a tech conference.
I would definitely sit on a stage with Elon Musk. I think what would be different, though, is the nature of the conversation that we'd have.
That, though, is not going to happen here in the UK, but we are going to spend quite a lot of the programme talking about one of the world's great economies, because Japan is going to elect their new leader in a few hours' time after Fumio Kishida surprised many when he announced that he was going to step down last month. But what do we know about those who want to take over from him? Japan's Liberal Democratic Party has had a string of scandals, and they now need a new popular face before a general election, which must be held by the middle of next year, where, of course, the economy will be one of the key issues that voters will be looking at. Our correspondent in Singapore is Marie Coy.
As they pose for a picture, it's a crowded race of nine contenders, all vying to be the next leader of the party and the government. Rank-and-file members of the Liberal Democratic Party will cast their vote for a new leader. If none of the candidates receives more than half of the votes, there'll be a runoff between the top two contenders. Based on multiple polls, there are three top candidates. That's Shinjiro Koizumi, who posted this video on X, formerly known as Twitter. If his name sounds familiar, that's because his father is former Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi. At age 43, he would become the youngest leader in post-war Japan if elected. Critics, though, say he lacks experience, but he is very popular among the public. On the economy, he's called for labor reforms to make it easier for companies to fire workers. That's Sanae Takaichi, who is known as a protege of Shinzo Abe, Japan's longest-serving prime minister. If elected, she would become the country's first ever female prime minister. Ms. Takaichi's economic policies are expected to be investor-friendly, just like her mentor. She's also known as one of the most conservative lawmakers in her party, so her leadership could likely affect Japan's relationship with its neighbors, China and South Korea. And Shigeru Ishiba, who's posted this video on social media promising to protect Japanese citizens from natural disasters. He's a veteran lawmaker who has previously been the party's secretary general and a defense minister. This is also the fifth time he's making a bid for the top job. He has proposed reviving Japan's rural areas to boost the economy and also floated the idea of raising the country's corporate tax. But he's also been criticized for not having a clear economic plan. The LDP ruled Japan for 65 of the last 69 years, but recent scandals have shaken up the political factions that have controlled this once dominant party. They are no longer the power players they used to be, making the result of this party leadership contest more unpredictable than ever before.
Mariko there, focusing on some of the candidates. Let's just remind ourselves of why the Japanese economy is so important. Kari Lee, he is an economist at Columbia University, familiar voice on the program. And we're talking about one of the world's great economies here, aren't we? They may have slipped behind Germany, but still the fourth biggest economy on this planet, Kerry.
That's very true. And for the U.S., it's been a very reliable partner, both economically and defense-oriented. But this is a country that has the biggest demographic problem in spades, where they have a shrinking population and they need to take on more foreign workers, even though there's worries in virtually every country we could pick about having more workers. But the country that gets the most immigrants and gets the most qualified immigrants is going to end up doing better in the economic performance in the next 5, 10, and 20 years. And so Japan really has to find a way to get their labor force moving higher rather than moving lower.
Yeah, that is going to be a big challenge for whoever comes into power next. But we earlier this year, didn't we had the Nikkei going down quite a lot on one day that triggered a lot of problems globally. Where do you think investors think Japan is at the moment?
Well, there has been a strong, well-reasoned argument that now is finally the time to buy into the Japanese economy, meaning there will be reforms being made, there'll be more immigration, there'll be and the like, and the ability to fire workers and the like. So I think that is considered by most investors, saying if you've had a case for Japan, it's probably had the best case in the last 10 years. It may not be a particularly strong case at the moment, but for people that want to diversify away from Europe and the U.S., that's probably as good a place to go as any.
Kerry, stay with us there. We're now going to hear from Sheila Smith, John E. Merko, Senior Fellow for Asia-Pacific Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we started our conversation by picking up on a point that Mariko made when she looked at the candidates about how significant a female leader could be for Japan.
So it's hard to say economically what it means, but it would be a symbolic. Japan ranks 120-something on the OECD ranking of women in leadership, right? So this would be quite a statement for the Japanese conservatives to pick a woman to lead their party. One of them is the current foreign minister, so she's got a lot of global experience. The other is somebody who has, let's just say, quite revisionist nationalist sort of points of views, things like going to Yasukuni Shrine. So she's a little bit on the right side of her conservative party.
And just for our listeners there, going there would be extremely provocative when it comes to relations with China, wouldn't it?
China and South Korea. So yes, it would upset Japan's two closest neighbors, South Korea and China. But it's an identity play on her part. She feels very strongly the time has come for Japan to have its national identity and to be unapologetic about it. She's quite unapologetic when it comes to hard power as well. On the economic front, you know, the two people who are liable to come out, one and two tomorrow, have very underplayed economic plans. Let's just put it that way.
Okay, why is that? Because a lot of our listeners will remember, you know, Abenomics, right. Economics was the basis
right.
of why so different now when it's such an important economy?
It is an important economy, and it's also an economy is facing significant demographic challenges going forward, right? But he led with his economic vision for Japan. And that was, you know, structural changes to the economy, getting more women involved, for example. Japan was engaged in trade and setting the rules for trade, and he joined the Trans-Pacific Partnership conversation at the time. So he's very forward-leaning on Japan's economic and really changed, I think, the Japanese public's idea of just what Japan could do economically. And he really did turn around the mindset, which I think is so vital to the current Japan, you know, Japanese economy. The Japanese now believe that they can do better, do better. They invest in their stock market, and they are doing better.
Is that maybe that one of the reasons why the economy is not in such focus? Because it's a very different time, isn't it, in terms of where inflation
is. Right. Inflation is, I don't know what the exact number is right now, but the inflation is manageable. Let's put it that way. Japan is brimming with tourists, right? You know, and tourism now, you know, accounts for 20% of GDP, you know, give or take. Japan is doing well. Among the nine people who spoke out most precisely about economic planning is the current Secretary General of the LDP, who's known to be a quite serious technocrat on the economy. But all of them basically said, we're going to focus on regional revitalization. The rural areas of Japan are suffering. They're suffering from hollowing out of population, hollowing out of industry, They're the backwater, so to speak, of this new economic dynamism that we're thinking of in Japan. And so you found all of the candidates, even the most sophisticated economist among them, really emphasizing, we're coming for you, rural areas, next. We're going to revitalize you. So I think that's been the political message of this campaign.
Who's going to win?
Oh, I think we're going to find it's going to be Mr. Ishiba.
Why?
I think there's still among the legislators, there's still some skepticism about him. But I think Takaichi also brings with her some kind of worry that she's not going to actually be able to lead the party in the general election. Whoever leads the party will take them into a snap election probably sooner rather than later. And they need a good, solid, reliable face on the party. I think at the end of the day, Ishiba probably offers that prospect more than Takaichi does. Takaichi has a harder time in the more broad public polling. Ishiba is very popular.
Sheila Smith there. We started with a preview of the candidates. We ended with a prediction of who's going to win. Not long to go till we find out. Let's move to Europe now, in Spain, where union groups have taken to the streets in support of a law that could shorten the working day. Sounds of some of the protests there as unions gathered around the country to put pressure on the National Employers Confederation to back the law, which would reduce the working week from 40 hours to 37.5 hours. The business lobby, though, has been pushing back. Isabel Woodford, the BBC's Isabel Woodford, has been following this story, and she told me what's been going on.
So this government of Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez are proposing reducing the work week by about 2.5 hours from the current 40, while keeping pay the same. So that's a big win for workers and unions, and that's pretty much in line with the socialist government's efforts so far to improve workers' conditions. The problem is the government want businesses to buy into the plan, and that's been tricky. The business lobby has been dragging their feet when it comes to talks, saying that the law will increase costs and complicate shift patterns. Talks have been going on between the employers and the union since January, but those discussions have basically broken down now. I was speaking earlier to Fernando Luján, who is the vice president of policy at the UGT union, which is leading these protests that we saw today. He said that businesses can afford this.
No parece.
It doesn't appear that a change of half an hour a day, making 2 hours a week, is going to create a business breakdown. If a company has to close half an hour early or has to reorganize its workers, it isn't going to cause a big issue. And if it does, then that business doesn't deserve to be called that. We're talking about 12 work days in the entire year. This isn't going to create an economic breakdown.
Okay, that sounds good for the workers, but for the economy, isn't that going to affect the economy? We're going to have people working less, basically.
Yeah, so this is essentially the debate. And for the unions, they're saying that Spain already lags behind what would be deemed the standard. So Spain has a higher average working week than the majority of Europe. And even though the Spanish are famed for afternoon siestas, the Spanish working day actually ends pretty late, usually around 7 or 8 p.m. Productivity in Spain also lags behind much of Europe. So, you know, the unions are saying this is going to make things better. A lot of the Western world, we're talking about 4-day working weeks, and pilots have shown that that has been really productive.
But here we have, don't we, the unions on one side, employers on the other side. What is going to happen? I suppose the government's going to have to decide which way to go. And it seems like they're with the unions on this.
Yeah, they're definitely with the unions on this. It makes sense for them as a kind of leftist government. And Luján, the vice president of the UGT union, said enough is enough. There needs to be a negotiation and they're not going to back down.
Vamos a continuar.
We're going to continue mobilizing. We're going to make Spanish workers aware of this measure. This isn't going to be hard because it's already supported by more than 80% of Spanish citizens. We're going to continue with this fight until there is an agreement that improves the working conditions for those in our country. And we're going to convince the political representatives, those in Parliament, that they have to legislate this.
So the union really has the government backed into a corner here, and it's likely that we will see progress by the end of the year. The government have said that they want to sweeten the deal for businesses. Reuters have reported that they're going to offer a hiring bonus to try and ease the shift pattern changes. And so it'll be a really interesting one to watch as this plays out towards the end of the year.
Kerry, Isabel, looking, what is an interesting story then? We were talking before, weren't we, about Japan and aging populations. Spain also has a relatively aging population, and it is a challenge, isn't it, if people are going to work less, of how you fill that gap.
Well, that's right. And perhaps if you had a sit down and have a trade where businesses would accept a mildly reduced work week and have a more flexible use of hours and time as well, then they would probably find a way to increase productivity as they cut the work week and probably reduce the potential inflationary impacts of this, which will be small in any event, but will be going in the wrong direction at this point in time for virtually any industrialized economy.
That is a really important point, though, isn't it? Because often we look at working hours and think the more that people work, the better it is for an economy. Not necessarily the case, because if you work less and you're more productive, that's far better.
Oh, absolutely. And we economists tend to forget that little things matter. Just the fact that the white-collar worker sits down with the blue-collar worker and asks about how can we make things better. While that doesn't sound very revolutionary in a lot of old-fashioned factories around the globe, that would be a revolutionary thing where you actually ask the worker, how would you do things more efficiently? And that's probably what they need to do to get these to get the work week to be cut.
We'll continue to follow those developments.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
In Spain, you're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. He's one of the richest men on the planet. He runs some of the most important companies and brands, and we talk about him quite a lot. So you would have thought that Elon Musk would be a prime candidate to be invited to the British government's first summit to try and attract investment into the UK, but he's not been invited because of things that he has said. That's despite Peter Kyle, the British Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology, referring to Musk as an extraordinary business person earlier this week.
I would definitely sit on a stage with Elon Musk. I think what would be different, though, is the nature of the conversation that we'd have. The thing that surprised me was that he wasn't pushed at all on any of the statements he's made and some of the decisions he's made with Twitter. But, you know, when it comes to Elon Musk, you know, again, he is a remarkable inventor, a remarkable innovator, and a quite extraordinary business person that can capitalize and commercialize those innovations. And I give him credit for that.
So Elon Musk's response to the lack of innovation was to post on X, "I don't think anyone should go to the UK when they're releasing convicted paedophiles in order to imprison people for social media posts." Evan Davis has been speaking to Vivian Schiller, the former head of news and journalism partnerships at Twitter.
Elon Musk likes to pick battles with national leaders, usually with the more progressive ilk. But without a doubt, this is not his first battle.
He's critical of the British, but he does business with a lot of countries who I think you would probably, most of us would imagine, are less democratic.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, he's in so many businesses, as you know, and he needs to continue those businesses. And a lot of times that's why so frequently, even though he talks a good game or tweets a good game or whatever you call it on X now, you know, he usually folds pretty quickly when he comes under political pressure because he's dependent on other nations for revenue for all of his companies. X is, you know, barely a blip, but, you know, Starlink and of course Tesla and SpaceX have significant, you know, those are significant.
Are you up, Vivian, with what's happened in Brazil? Obviously, we heard that he'd found workarounds for the ban on X in Brazil.
Again, he caved into the pressure ultimately. First, he ranted and raved on X and, you know, he did have his lawyers there. But in the end, he agreed to the two conditions that Brazil put on him, the Supreme Court justice, which was to ban certain accounts and also to have a representative, a legal representative in Brazil. He stood, you know, strong in air quotes, I'm saying that he stands for free speech and he will never cave against this. But they went very hardcore. They even, you know, extracted funds from Brazilian-based accounts to pay the fees. And he is now, in fact, agreed to ban those accounts that they demanded, as well as have a legal representative.
Kerry, do you think that Elon Musk's outspokenness is beginning to cost him when it comes to his business?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at statistics on the Tesla about people who are considering buying it, ever since he started making more and more outrageous statements on X and elsewhere, those numbers have gone down. So it's affected his Tesla business in sort of an indirect way. And I think he really needs big governments. And he had a hell of a lot of subsidies for Tesla and other things he's doing, such as Skylink. And if he gets on the wrong side of people who are writing the checks, they may not want to write him any more checks to get his business going. But though there's no doubt he's a brilliant businessman, he is sort of a wild and crazy guy.
Let us see what happens with let's look at the markets now. Again, another record close from the S&P, and it looks like AI again driving the markets in the U.S.
Yes. What I meant was the big positive story was Micron saying that its businesses were up and it was going expected to do even better. So there was another good tech story, and that lifted the market higher, at least a bit.
It certainly did. Let's talk about one of the big companies that is associated with AI, OpenAI. We've had those departures. We've had these rumors about equity going to its founder, Sam Altman, moving away from that not-for-profit model. Here is Sam Altman speaking about those departures at an event in Italy.
I think this will be hopefully a great transition for everyone involved, and OpenAI will be, you know, stronger for it as we are for all of our transitions.
What do you make of what's going on with OpenAI, along with NVIDIA? It really is one of the companies of the year, or the last couple of years, probably.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're seeing an old-fashioned gold rush, and everybody wants to get on board, even the ones that were talking about the altruism behind the development of this product, which they've been talking about this for decades now, saying, well, there's just too much money not to at least dip your toes in there, because the amount of money that the executives can make in this business is just extraordinary. And I think you're seeing that it's just too good to be true. So you might as well take advantage of it until it moves against you.
But if you have so many people leaving the company, that must affect it in the long run.
Oh, absolutely. It will hurt the company. It will slow them down. But I think the belief is that while you're trying to pick winners and losers, someone else will pick up the slack, and that the overall industry will do well, though the leader you think it might be might not be the one today. It might be 5 years down the road. The old remark about Henry Ford not inventing the motor car is very true, and you got to be able to market this stuff, and the marketers may make more money than the creators.
There's been a lot of focus on China this week, lots of measures announced to stimulate the faltering economy. Well, today they focused on the housing market. Here's our China correspondent, Stephen McDonnell.
It's a big deal here because real estate sector was a quarter of the gross domestic product of all of China a couple of years ago, and it's been in a terrible state for years. What they've said today they're going to do is to strictly control any increase in new commercial housing construction. Now, the reason that is seen as maybe working is that up until now, these developers have been going further and further into debt, building forests of towers in places people don't want them to somehow stay ahead of the creditors. And it's forced value of all these homes to drop. There's too many of them in the wrong places. And so if you control it a bit, the idea is that it'll drive up the prices of the places already there. It'll force the developers to finish the ones they haven't finished, and there are an awful lot of them, and restore confidence in the housing market.
That is important, isn't it? What have you made of the announcements that China has made this week, the world's second largest economy, Kerry? A real effort to try and get it back on track?
Oh, I think so. They have enormous problems. The amount of overfunding in the housing industry and other misallocation of investment is right. But they have that very complicated and hard to figure out financing through the state and local governments. And that's where they really have to clean up the messes. But any curtailment of supply right now would be very helpful and probably shore up the market. But they just have way too much investment in all the wrong places and wrong geographical spots, too.
Yeah, but what we have seen this week is we've seen the Chinese stock market rebound, haven't we? We've seen the Hong Kong stock market rebound. And across Asia, stock markets have reacted well to the efforts that the Chinese are taking. So good for their economy, but also, really importantly, good for the global economy.
Oh, absolutely. You don't want China to be weak, even though you may want to restrict their imports their exports around the globe. But yes, that's all very positive. And if you believe the market is functioning rationally, it's giving a thumbs up on what China's doing. And they think the proposal is bigger and more serious than they would have thought even 1 or 2 weeks ago.
Do you think we're sometimes too hard on China? If we look at projected growth, they want 5%, they may get 4.5%. A lot of countries would love to have that sort of growth. Are we comparing it too much about the growth that it's had in the past?
I agree with you. I mean, given the size of the economy now, to grow 5% is quite an accomplishment. It's just the question of, are they doing it in a way that is free and fair, and are they going to hollow out a lot more industrial base around the globe and be too dominated in areas that people are realizing you need to have some domestic production?
I suppose the question is, do you believe those figures? Because there is a lot of people who look at China's figures and still are skeptical, aren't they?
They are, but even if they're off by 25 to 40%, you're still talking about a growth rate of well over 3%, and that's still impressive in an economic growth scheme of a major industrialized country that they're real happy if they're growing at 2%.
Let's move across a little bit from China, but stay in Asia, because this time on Wednesday here on World Business Report, we were, of course, talking about Pakistan and the funding it will receive from the IMF, crucial to reignite its economy. On Thursday, of course, people have been reacting to that news in Pakistan. Amongst them is Kanwal Malik. She's a businesswoman based in Karachi, Pakistan's commercial capital.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show today. It is a great achievement for the current government to obtain this $7 billion loan from the IMF program, which is a 37-month loan. However, it poses a lot of responsibility on the current government. The political stability will definitely fade the program and the economy. How it implements reforms here, such as, you know, no subsidies from provinces or taxes on the agriculture sector, they all are in need of reforms. And all these ideas and visions, they require a very high level commitment from all political parties across the provinces. It would be a collective effort for the long-lasting progress and stability of our country and the region in particularly. And we believe that the priority should now be on creating sustainable long-term value, like through technological advancements and policy reforms, and obviously with a clear focus on a long-term vision. The past financial injections have proven insufficient, and you know, making it essential that these comprehensive reforms in the bureaucratic as well as the political and socioeconomic sectors must be implemented for lasting progress and stability of Pakistan.
Kanwal Malik there, Kerry, final thoughts from you. You know, we talk a lot, don't we, about stock markets going up across the world, but a clear reminder there that many economies are still struggling.
That is so true. And this is actually a big deal because the IMF is going to offer you a quite a bit of money to places like Pakistan and elsewhere. But for reforms that actually mean something, and they will check at very regularly. So there'll be people from the IMF flying to Pakistan and other areas where they made a lot of support to make sure that changes are being made. But it's just very difficult to grow in this kind of environment if you don't have a relatively flexible capital and labor markets.
Yeah. Thanks for all your comments today. Kerry, Pakistan's finance minister, said in the short term, things may be difficult, but in the long term, things will get better. That is it for World Business Report.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.